before they talk this evening, somebody just talking beforehand and just having a chat before we came in here, they were asking an interesting question about a saying which they have in Buddhism, to be an island of a refuge to oneself. But how can you be that? Because now, how can you stay with yourself for too long? Because in our modern world, that many people just are alone. They live alone. Even they may have other people in their house, they're still alone. And sometimes that people can't find partners, so they are alone. Or sometimes that they're partner passes away or departs for some other reasons and they are alone. Can you be happy that way? Of course you can. But how can you do that? And of course that's my credibility for actually talking about this. The reason why I can know what I'm talking about when I talk to solitude was that we're trying to figure out when this was. It's sometime between, in this century anyway, 2000 and 2008 was the latest. I spent 6 months without seeing any human being, without talking to anybody else. What had happened, it was, I was supposed to have a sabbatical, a year off. But then, one thing led to another. I can only have 6 months off. So you could go anywhere in the world. Where would you like to go for 6 months? I could go touring here, visiting this monastery or that monastery. But I said, no. Why do people always have to seek for happiness somewhere else? Why can't I find that happiness right where I am, in that monastery, where I work so hard to build it up? So I said, no, I'm not going to seek for happiness, contentment anywhere else. I could go wherever I wanted to, but I decided to find the best happiness and truth and freedom and wisdom right here. So I had a hut in the forest in Serpentine, and I stayed there for 6 months. Never went anywhere, except deeper and deeper inside. And it was arranged that we had a box. Actually, where's that box now? The box which, I think it's over, okay, it's still there somewhere. Anyway, yeah, we had a little box there, and in the morning, at a certain time, about 10:30, one of the monks would actually put that my bowl with food in the box. And I would know the time they were coming, so I knew, you know, to be in my hut. And afterwards, I would go to the box, open it up, eat the food, and then wash the bowl, put it the box in there for the next day. So I never, it's much better than Uber Eats. It was Monk Eats. So I never got charged, I never saw anybody. So there I was, and they knew I was alive because they'd seen my bowl and food was eaten. So, and it could have been the kangaroos, I suppose, eating the food, but no, it was me. Although sometimes those kangaroos, you know, they're really, really, really smart. And they soon found out that I was, you know, in that hut. And sometimes, you know, you'd leave your food outside on the veranda, it's a walking path, you'd leave the bowl there just for a few minutes to go inside to get something, because I like eating on the veranda at first. And you know what happened? You find a kangaroo with his head inside my bowl, taking the first choice of food before I even got to it. And so from that time I decided to eat inside my hut. And so I'd eaten inside, but you know, the window was open. And the kangaroo would come up onto my path and look at me through the window. And, it was a poor kangaroo. So, you know, you felt sort of some compassion for this poor. They had plenty of grass. But then I started by putting some healthy food outside. I remember, like a carrot or some But you know, they weren't interested in that. You know the food they liked the most? When I was on retreat? Pizza. Honest. And it's almost, I don't know if it's healthy for them, but you know, that's what the kangaroos decided they wanted to eat. See a little kangaroo with a little pizza in their mouth. They love that. But anyway, let's go back to the solid. So I saw kangaroos and I had some nice conversations with kangaroos. Can animals speak? Do you think they can? Sometimes that people think that's crazy. Spend 6 months by yourself and you end up talking to kangaroos. But oh, this amazing stuff happens with these animals in the forest. If you're very peaceful, of course they have some understanding. I don't know if I still have this little photo which somebody gave me from Burma. I think it's in the back of the hall, back of the library somewhere. It was a snake photo. Because the story was, it was given me, I think, by a Burmese monk. And it was an amazing story that it was written in Burmese on the back. But there was a girl in Yangon, when she was young, she so claimed in her previous life to have been a python, a snake, in her previous life. Which is a weird thing to start with. But then she also said that she was obviously a very special python because she lived on the shoulder of an old Buddha statue in a cave in upcountry Burma. And with two other pythons. And they were treated with great dignity by the villagers because they lived actually on a Buddha statue. And in Burma, you may know, it's a very strong Buddhist country, and sometimes people say, oh, that's just myths. But their parents were intrigued enough to ask, you know, where that village was, really up country, and to make a visit there, a long trek for several days. And when they actually got to this village, it matched. There were still two pythons left. And every moon day, they were taken, you know, ceremoniously, you know, handled by the village elders and taken out to be bathed. And then afterwards brought back to the statue where they lived. And someone had a photo of the three when they were still alive. Now there was only two. Sometimes you think, oh, that's crazy stuff, Ajahn Brahm. You know, you've been a monk too long, and it's a hot weather today. You know, you've been in the sun for too long. But unfortunately, I've just seen too much. And my credibility also, you know, theoretical physics, Cambridge University, okay? So, you know, you experiment, you're a scientist, you look at these things, and my goodness, you see some things which you cannot ignore. So anyway, so there are some people who, you know, can talk to animals. You seen any animal whisperers? You know, so apparently they're on TV or something. And they're amazing what they can do. So anyway, so I was, you know, one of the wonderful animals I saw over there, there was a pair of eagles. And you see them flying in the afternoon, about the same time, with a little baby. And when I first saw it, I always made sure I was going to come out that time in the afternoon to see them. And to see them flying in the air, training their kid to fly. And to see it get bigger and bigger and bigger over, say, a month, every afternoon, until obviously the baby eagle was big enough to look after itself. Just that was just towards the south of Bodhinyana Monastery. You see some beautiful things there. And anyway, how can you spend such a long time in solitude without going crazy? And apparently 6 months alone, by myself, and not talking to anybody, that sometimes people say, wow, you must really go mad. And apparently when I came here for my first talk, there was a few people disappointed. Disappointed I hadn't gone crazy. They were expecting me to have these big wide eyes and really long hair and a beard, like the crazy monk from Serpentine. If I'd have gone really crazy and looked really wild, then I would have probably got off in the newspapers. that would be newsworthy. Strange, isn't it? But when I come off nice and peaceful and blissed out, you know, that's not really newsworthy. Isn't it weird that people like sort of crazy stuff, but peaceful stuff, they're not that interested in? Anyway, that's the subject of another talk. But how could you actually do that for 6 months without going mad? And it was always because during that time, I knew how to be my best friend. To actually learn how to be at peace with myself, with my body, with my mind. Learn how to not to make war with myself. It's not that hard. You know, a lot of times people, they do react to difficulties with trying to exterminate those difficulties, making war with them, instead of making peace with them. So you may have a partner in life you're trying to get rid of. Or those of you who are single are trying to find a partner. You know, either way it doesn't make much difference. You've heard me say before that if you are with somebody, if you are married, you've got married persons suffering. And then you get rid of your partner one way or another, and then you find you don't have married person suffering anymore, you have single person suffering. And so then you decide, well, I don't want to be single, I don't want to be married, so what can I do? And then you become a monk or a nun. You know what happens then? You have monk suffering. So, that's because you always want to be something different. You want to go somewhere else. You're not really happy to be here. Oh, you kids, are you looking forward to going to school on Tuesday, Wednesday? Some people can't wait to go to school, see their friends, and as soon as they're at school, they can't wait for school to finish. Have you ever noticed we always want to be somewhere else in life? So, this is actually how to be at peace with yourself. To be able to be kind to yourself, be kind to this moment. Instead of trying to cure and get rid of things, to care for things. At all, not curing, but caring. And when you understand what that really means, you try and make peace with this moment. You don't fight it, you make peace with it. When you make peace with this moment, and you are kind, open the door of your heart to this moment, being compassionate to this moment, you find this moment is actually very beautiful. And when you become at ease with this moment, you find you can be at ease with yourself, with this old body, this old mind, telling really stupid jokes sometimes. Actually, not sometimes, all the time. All these times which you try and fight yourself, you're not learning how to be a friend to yourself. When you're with your best friend, you can spend so much time with them. You know, sometimes people always say that they find the best friendship with a dog. That's why sometimes they say the dog is your best friend. Why? It's because a dog never argues with you. They never ask for things. They, even if you say rotten things to them, they still lick you afterwards. It's amazing. A dog is just so compassionate and tolerant and just likes to be with you. So that's why some people, you know, if you can't find a partner in life, get a dog. Much easier to actually look after. They don't. But anyway, why is it that when we're with a best friend who doesn't criticize us, who doesn't ask for things, who's just happy to be with us, why is it they teach us so much love? Why can't we learn from those experiences how to be at peace with ourselves. But not demanding things from ourselves, not trying to do better. Over in the world, we're always trying to achieve this and to increase our experience and our qualifications, and we're always trying to advance in life, but there's something really wrong with that. Always trying to improve. What's wrong with you? Why do you have to improve? Aren't you good enough already? That's one of the things that sometimes I thought, well, why are you always trying to improve? Come on, get on in life. Get on in life. Well, where am I getting on to? Well, you know, do better. Do better than I'm doing my best. You can't do better than your best. So why can't we be at peace with ourselves? In other words, learn how to love ourselves like a dog will love you. Just loves you for who you are. You may be tired. You may be sick. That's why sometimes they have these pet therapies in hospitals. And they really work. They're teaching people to learn how to love themselves. They don't need to be healthy. They don't need to be fit. They don't need to be anything. The dog just loves you. So this is something which I learned, how to love myself. How to be at peace with myself. How to accept myself. So there I was, just in my own space for 6 months, but I was never alone. I was always with my best friend, and I didn't have a dog. The dogs, you know, would go and chase kangaroos and other animals in the forest. They don't really belong in forests, not in Australian forests. But I had my best friend with me for 6 months, and that was me. I was at peace with myself, at ease with myself. I'd opened the door of my heart to myself a long time ago. Just again, like my father taught me, son, this is what he said to me, and I've mentioned this so often before, but this story, if you can, once I say the story, it can go so many different ways, and it's this amazing little explanation of what real love and making peace mean in real life. When he said to me, son, wherever you go in your life, I was 14 years of age, the door of my heart would always be open to you. And it's always open to the mobile phones as well. Please don't criticize your mobile phones. That's just what mobile phones do. So the door of my heart is open. Oh, that's even wonderful. Thank you, mobile phone, for responding to my kindness with your beautiful music. So when my father said, the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you ever do, that meant something really important. It meant that he was going to give me his love, his acceptance, no matter what I ever did. And that's what it meant. And that just, I couldn't really understand just the power of that until much later. And of course, I tried that with many other people, each one of you. Doesn't matter what you do, the door of my heart will always be open to you. And also to me. So the door of my heart, a long time ago, opened. Whoever I was, whatever I did, I could make peace with myself. You know, sometimes we find it so hard to love others in this world. The main reason is because we don't know how to love ourselves. It's so hard on ourselves. And the classic story, which I'm going to take the opportunity to mention here, and this is going to be interactive. So listen carefully, because there's going to be a question at the end of this story. So this was a story which teaches people about what open the door of your heart is. There were 7 monks who were meditating in a cave, deep in a jungle, a long way away. And those 7 monks, listen carefully, who they were. The first monk was the head monk. The second was his brother. They'd become monks together. The third was his best friend. The fourth was his enemy. Now, wonder why do 2 monks live together and they just cannot get on. But you know, some people have just got personality conflicts. They're both really good people, but they just cannot get on. So the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so old that he was, no one knew when he was going to die. Any day now, he would probably cark it. Well, you know, I shouldn't say that maybe, but he would abandon his body. He would die. So he was the fifth monk. And the sixth monk, he was so sickly, so ill, even with the best care in the world and medicines, that it was just no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. And the last monk, number seven, was the useless monk. As I say, every monastery has one. You go to Dharamsala and ask which one it is. But even though, whenever they chant, they always chant out of key. As soon as they meditate, they fall asleep. Worse than that, they start snoring. Whenever they can't even wear their robes on properly, they always come and fall off. They always fall off. Oops. Maybe that's how I started. And they can't give a Dhamma talk when they come up here to give a talk and everyone leaves. Or they say the wrong thing. But you know, give them a chance. Those are the useless monks. And so that was number seven, the useless monk. Never done any sort of real thing of really great use in his whole life, but he was a monk. So anyway, remember those seven monks. And then this band of thieves and robbers, these really bad guys, came and they found that cave in the jungle, excellent place for their hideout. They were going to take that over as a place where they could store all their stolen goods and also to hide when the police were after them. So they could hide there for a while and then they could store their goods as well. But there's one trouble with that cave. The monks had found it first. And they were scared. They couldn't let the monks go because all those monks went, what would happen is one of them would tell the police, the authorities, where that cave was. So the head monk, the head thief, decided he was going to kill all those monks, to slaughter them. These are really bad dudes. The thieves, that was, not the monks. Obviously. So anyway, that they said, we're going to kill you all so no one lets the police know where the cave is. And the head monk said, well, why kill us all? We won't tell. We won't believe you. How can we trust you? And they came to a deal, the only deal which the thieves would accept, that the thieves would kill one of those monks in front of all the rest as a warning that these were serious thieves. And if any monk, once they let them go, any of the remaining six monks, if they would tell any policeman that the thieves would come for them and do the same to them, they had to show a warning to the rest of the monks. So that was the best the head monk could do. So, the head monk had to decide who would have to die so all the other monks could go free. So imagine you were that head monk. Who would you choose to die so all the rest could go free? But before you answer, remember the list of seven monks. The head monk, his brother, his best friend, the enemy, the old monk. And the old monk's about to die anyway. You know, he's only just shortening his life by a couple of days. Sick monk, the same. You know, he's going to die soon. So. And the last one, the useless monk, throughout his whole life, never done anything for anybody of great use. Maybe he could find a use after all that time. So if you're that head monk, who would you choose? And if you heard this before, don't spoil it by putting your hand up and saying what the answer is. So, who was chosen? Useless man, thank you. That was wrong. But I know you know the story before, you've heard it before. Just breaking the ice. The enemy, thank you, but no, yes? Head monk. Okay, be honest with you. If you think that's the right answer, put your hand up. Of course, thank you for indulging me, because you're all wrong. That's the wrong answer. You know, I've done that this one time, it was a Christian bishop, an Episcopalian bishop, over in Sacramento in the United States. And he wanted to understand something about, you know, Buddhism, but I asked him that question. Of course, he said he sacrificed himself. And when I told him, said that's the wrong answer, you know, when I gave him the right answer, he said, wow, that is just so amazing. It goes way beyond sort of the divisions between religions and speaks to the heart of religion. And he said, asked if he could use that in his sermons, which he probably, you know, I said, certainly you can. No one owns truth. It's there to be used to make people peaceful and happy. But the answer was, that many of you know now, was he could not choose. Because the head monk's love and respect to his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love for his best friend. He loved even the enemy equally. And he loved the old monk and the sick monk, the dear old monk, the sick monk, the useless monk. He loved them all equally, but most importantly, he loved himself no more, no less than everybody else. That's why it was impossible for him to choose. And at that point, when I was teaching this to the bishop, I told him, said, don't you remember your teacher, Jesus, telling you to love your enemy as yourself? No, love your neighbor as yourself. Doesn't that mean to love yourself as your neighbor? No more, no less. Wow, he got it. Why is it we always sacrifice ourselves? First, it's because there's something very wrong with our psychology, with our spirituality. It means that we don't love ourselves. We sacrifice ourselves. But does loving yourself mean you're going to be selfish? No. The old story, when I do blessed marriages, that look in the wife's eyes, the new bride, say from now on, from now on you're a married woman, you must not think of yourself. Yes, she says. The guy, you must not think of yourself. Yes, he says. Then the guy, you must not think of your wife from this moment on. But he admits, okay, yes, I don't know why, but I trust you, Rajan Brahm. And then, telling the wife, you must not think of yourself from this moment on. You must not think of your husband from this moment on. Because once you're married, you must not think of yourself. That's called selfishness. It's not a marriage. You must not think of the other partner. That's where you burn out. So who should you think of? Us. The third option. In other words, loving yourself means that you count no more, no less than everybody else. But the reason I tell that story is because most times people sacrifice themselves, they don't love themselves. Which is one of the reasons why you can't spend time in solitude. After a while, you just go a bit mad or crazy, or you want to turn on the TV. Or you want to sort of see what's happening in the news. Or you want to sort of find out sort of, you know, what's happening outside. We cannot sit still. We cannot find peace in our life. Why? Because we don't love ourselves. To love oneself or love another person, you don't have to be perfect. It is a wonderful thing to realize. You love yourself as you are. Otherwise, you have to be perfect. It's just a strain, always trying to be perfect. Especially, I must admit, this is gender bias, but you poor ladies, you have to spend so much time. Have you ever seen anybody in high heels? That's torture. makeup and hair and stuff. Okay, maybe give you, if you want to do that, fine. But I do remember going to Melbourne once. I'll never forget this. Because people were having these halter tops. They're having low-strung trousers or skirts and just high top pieces. And this big expanse of skin in Melbourne in the winter time. And it's going blue. And what do you do that for? For a guy? Is that worth it? I think some of you are laughing because you recognize that story. And there's, what do you do for, you know, to hurt yourself so much trying to get somebody else? You know, to share your pain with you? So it showed me there's something there that's not really loving and caring for yourself. And just, you know, thinking that your happiness comes with a partner. The happiness comes by being at ease in your own skin, being at peace with yourself, understanding who you are, and then it's so easy to have a relationship with somebody else. It's not a relationship where you actually need another person. Oh, welcome into my life if you wish to come. But you don't have to if you don't want to. It's beautiful love and peace. Which is one of the reasons why I can go off into the cave and have a wonderful time being with me. Being my own best friend, having a wonderful time just being there. Peaceful, because when you're happy with yourself, you're not trying to get somewhere else, do something else, improve yourself, try and get some. Oh, what was that story? This fellow, he could never find a partner. He went to a psychologist, and the psychologist gave it to him straight. He said, look at you. You know, that number one, you dress so, you know, out of fashion. You're so daggy with the way you dress. So he said, if you want to find a partner, go to a tailor and get a really sharp suit or something which is more fashionable. And look at your hair. Your hair is just all over the place, and it's dirty and greasy too. Get a proper haircut. No, no, look, teeth. The teeth are all crooked and stinky. Just now go to a good dentist and just get your teeth all straightened up and have some personal hygiene. And also, said, why not see if you could get a personality coach? You know, to get yourself more charming. And he said, well, that costs a huge amount of money, he said, but it'd be worth it. So he decided to follow the therapist's advice. You know, he took a lot of money getting his teeth all fixed up and straightened, a personality coach, and make him more positive and attractive, and a nice, really expensive, you know, haircut, and really fancy clothes, and getting just really all prepared. He went out for the first time, and as he was going into a singles club to meet the love of his life, he hoped, he was hit by a truck and killed. And when he went to heaven, he was really upset. He said, God, why did you do that for? You didn't even give me a day after observing all that money and all that pain and stuff, you know, getting myself all attractive. And God said, well, I didn't recognize you. It was an old joke. But so anyway, So, nice thing. Learn how to sort of be at peace with yourself and love yourself. And then you're happy even if you're alone or with others. You don't need and have to depend upon others. That dependence on somebody else instead of being a refuge to yourself. You can be with other people. You can also be alone. And that's one of the great things as a monk. It's not only that, because as you spend lots of time by yourself, without distraction, alone, life gets very interesting. You become so much more sensitive to yourself and the world around you. With other people and with work, we get so busy. So busy that it's hard to find time to stop and find out who you're really living with. This body of mind called you, which bears your name. And actually, that sometimes when you do have some solitude, while we built retreat centers to have time by yourself, that's where you get to know who you really are. not just know who you really are, because you become so still and peaceful, you can actually start to understand what the world has been teaching you all alone. Sometimes we just talk back to the world incessantly. It's called thinking. It's called planning. It's called worrying and just being obsessed with the pain of the past. When I say obsessed with the pain of the past, I was telling someone recently that when I went to a pain and loss conference many years ago, and there was a person, there was a very, her daughter was one of the victims of the Claremont killer. And anyway, after I gave her some really nice advice about how to let go of her pain, she came up to me, and she, nose to nose almost, she was so angry. And she said, "How dare you try to take away my grief?" It was one of the first times I realized that people would rather have pain and grief than be free when they've got used to it so long. They haven't really been listening to what life has been teaching them. So sometimes, if we spend more time in solitude, sometimes we can learn so much what the world, what nature always teaches us. Things like, we're not going to be together all the time. The times when we have to part from the people we love the most. But it doesn't mean we get anxious. It means we enjoy those moments as long as we possibly can, instead of wasting them all with fear when they're going to go. Instead, we can savor every moment. That's what When Things Disappear teaches. When we can save, when the people we love and care for are right with us, we can enjoy their company. And when they leave, they go with our blessing. "Thank you for being part of my life for such a long time. But because you have another person you can stay with, yourself, you're happy in your own company," it also means you don't desperately try and keep people with you all the time. "I don't know what I'll do without you." I know what you can do without them. If you love yourself as much as you love others, then you're always with someone you feel and find is a comforter, a healer, a really good friend. Many people these days live in solitude, and they enjoy that. Many people live with their children, loving them to bits, and they enjoy that. But all you mothers and fathers know that one day your son, your daughter, will fly away to the other sides of the world. And of course you'll miss them terribly, but let them go with your blessing. I remember what my poor old mum, when I was 17, I shouldn't give all the young men here ideas, but I've got too late now. 17, I had a sleeping bag, my guitar, and I went hitchhiking from London over to North Africa. Must have driven my mum crazy. But off I went to explore the world. And she gave me her blessing. What a courageous thing that was. And of course I came back and looked after her. But that's one of the things which we do. We learn that ability to love ourselves, to love others, and to love life. Do you love life? People think they do. But life is always includes sickness and death and separation. That's also a part of life. So when people say they love life, they usually say they love only the nice part of life, the pleasant part. A person who really loves life understands everything about it, the whole of it. They understand themselves. They learn their weaknesses, their strengths, all about themselves. That's who you are. The trees in the forest, the sunset over the Indian Ocean at night time, in the evening, when there's a few clouds in the sky, imperfections, you get the best sunsets. When there's no dust or smoke or clouds at all, it's blue, but it doesn't spread the colors as much as when there's a little bit of imperfection. That's why imperfection is beauty in my eyes. You don't have to be perfect to be delightful. Your partner, you will never make them perfect. Why? Because you're not perfect. Your child will never be perfect. Not in the teacher's eyes, but in mum's eyes, in dad's eyes, always perfect. So remember that, kids. You're going to go to school, and you're going to get criticized, and sometimes your kids, your teachers say you're not good enough. Even if you're an Einstein, you can always do better. That's what teachers sometimes do. But remember, you are more than good enough. I'm going to finish off with a little story I told earlier. It's one of the old stories I told a long time ago. Of course it's a joke. About the kid who came home from school. And he told his dad, said, "How'd you go at school today, son?" And his son said, "Dad, today teacher asked a question and I was the only one in class who knew the right answer." And the father was both surprised and impressed, saying, "Usually you get in detention. Usually you get extra homework. Just how come today, you know, you did so well?" And he said, "Oh, well, I just knew the right answer, Dad." And Dad said, "I'm so proud of you," and gave him a $20 note as a reward, trying to encourage him to be smart in the future. And so as the kid took the $20 and walked out of the room, the dad said, "Oh, by the way, what question did your teacher ask? Who broke the window in the classroom?" So anyway, that's learning how to love yourself and learn how to be at peace with yourself. You're not half as bad as you expect yourself to be. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so any questions? What about from the people here, first of all? You always got put in second line. Anyone here has a question they would like to ask? And don't ask who broke the school window. Okay, we've got some questions. Oh, the question maybe some people would like to ask, they always ask this, in that story about the seven monks and the thieves, what happened afterwards? Once the monk said he couldn't make the decision because he loved everybody equally. Now this is based on Taraputta's Tara. Very loosely based, but it is based on that story in the Theragata, that the thieves were so impressed with that answer, and they learned something which was not religious as much as spiritual, had deep meaning. Well, that's what love really is. You love everybody equally. That the thieves were so impressed that they let all the monks go, and half of the thieves became monks, and the other half went back to the village and got a proper job. It can happen. It does happen. Why are people bad people? Are they really bad people? They're just running away from themselves because they're afraid of who they are. And they love themselves. Even the leader of the thieves, "Ah, I'm not such a bad guy after all." Can that happen? Yes, it can. Okay, anyway, questions from overseas here. Being alone for long periods of time is followed by tension and fear. Why is that? Is it a natural process because we're social beings? It is not a natural process. It is a cultural conditioning to feel that we are social beings. Because, again, for long periods it's sometimes followed by tension and fear. Only when you feel that there's something missing. And when you don't feel there's something missing, you know you're with yourself, you're with life. Social beings, sometimes when you're with yourself for such a long period of time. Look, an interesting point of that, whenever we teach retreats, We try and keep, this is a 9-day retreat, so even longer, we try and keep silence on retreats. In other words, you know, no talking. And when we try, you know, some of these days I'm going to really lay down the law and get everyone to put in their mobile phones and iPhones before they go on retreat. Because in Jhana Grove, the retreat center there, there's very, very bad reception. That's done on purpose. It's in a valley. But you see, after a few days, people get their mobile phone. They know where all the good reception is. Right at the top, you know, by the by the road. But anyway, just being silent even for 9 days. At first, I can't talk to anybody. Oh, and they feel this is just like a military camp. But after 9 days, I haven't done this recently. I say, okay, the last day you can talk. And nobody wants to talk. They're relaxed and at ease with communicating without speech. They're at peace with one another. They've bonded already in silence. You don't get sort of tense and fear. And sometimes you have these Christian monasteries that's silent for a long period of time. Years sometimes. And they are not tense or afraid. They just go to another level of communication, especially with nature. When we're talking so much, communicating with other people, it's actually distracting us from real life. Certainly that's what you find. When I was 6 months of retreat, you really understand your own nature, the nature of this mind, the nature of the world. And all these little animals, which, you know, you live with. There's a really big, I know this size of this big dugite. He was, I think, 2.7 meters long. Because it was a hot day, and he just wanted to shade under the side of the hut I was living in, the Kuti. And because I built that, I knew the dimensions. So I knew he was 2.7 meters long. And as soon as he came, the kangaroos alerted me. They were running out of the way, afraid of this huge little, snake. And he came and he looked at me, and I was in striking distance. He just looked at me and I looked at him and wished him well and just carried on washing my bowl. And then the next thing I knew, I turned around and he was pointing in the other direction. He realized, he was okay with me, I was okay with him. And he was just wanting some shade, that's all, on a hot day. And you get to know animals. And they're not afraid of them, they're not afraid of you. And, you know, you can be kind to them. Or was it just some little time before? We had a gardener who was coming up every day to do some work at Burton Yard. And he told me, on the corner of Kingsbury Drive and Southwest Highway, he just noticed as he came early one morning, not much traffic, there was a parrot was on a branch of a tree looking down at a dead parrot which had been hit by a car maybe early that morning. And when he finished work, he noticed that parrot was still there, looking down, hadn't moved. The next morning, the parrot was still on the tree, looking down. For about 3 or 4 days, the parrot hadn't moved, looking down at the dead parrot on the side of the road. If that wasn't grief, I don't know what is. Because parrots, they mate for life. If one of them dies or passes away, they don't take another partner. They're lifelong. And for many years parrots live. And so there was a parrot who had lost its partner and spent 3 days not moving on a tree, just looking down. There's something about life which you could experience when you're not so busy. When you live alone in a forest especially, it's amazing what you learn. Anyway, sorry, I keep answering questions and giving other talks. How do we know if we open the door of our heart more and more over time? Because you get more and more peaceful, more and more easy to get on with, less and less demanding of other people. And when you open the door of your heart to others, and you open it, it has to be both ways, to others and to yourself, you get more peaceful, more understanding. So in life, instead of thinking that something's gone wrong, what can go wrong? If you open the door of your heart to life, make peace with it. How does one cultivate self-love in difficult and politically uncertain times, when the government seems to be dividing people and assigning their value based on their passport and not real merits? Again, that's one of the greatest ways of showing love to others, is being at peace with yourself. And if you are at peace with yourself, you understand how to create peace with others. Sometimes people, they want to control you with fear, with anger. People seem to be dividing people. Can a government actually divide people? Or is it the case that we allow ourselves to be divided? What stops you going to meet and help somebody who's in pain? And knocking on their door and being with them? Value based on their passport? I have two passports. I'd love to get more, but apparently, because that comes to, why is that? That value based on the passport, the value is based upon something much more than where you were born, or how educated or not educated you are, what your family is. Even I think, and I quote this because, you know, I was brought up as a Christian at school, by their deeds ye shall know them. Who said that? Jesus said that. You're not a high class because of who your parents were. You're a Brahmin by your deeds. That was the Buddha saying that. In other words, you value a person by their acts, not just by, you know, where they came from, what their education is, what the colour of their skin, what their gender, what their sexual preferences are. If they're a good person, that is why you value them. And that's one of the beautiful things which, you know, the great religious inspiring leaders will tell you. So, we value not just merit in the sense of a meritocracy, but their goodness, their kindness, and all peoples, all religions, all races and sort of cultures know what is good and what is bad. Remember Dr. K.C. Dhammananda, who was a very wonderful monk. He did so much to let Buddhism in Malaysia really grow and prosper. And there, I remember him having a conference with, you know, some of the very strict observant Islamic leaders. And just saying, just, you have to be a Buddhist or a Muslim to know that killing, stealing, hurting other people is wrong? This is something which you know in your heart is wrong. Do you have to go to school to know that harming other people is wrong? This is something which is deeply embedded in us, which is one of the reasons why that governments, religious leaders, and I'm a religious leader, sort of dividing people. No, we should be uniting people, bringing people together. In pretty uncertain times, finish off. That's the second time I said finish off. When I was asked, what's the Buddhist idea of God? Now, I could say many things about that. I can say we don't believe in a God. Whoa. Difference of opinion. Instead, I said, this was in front of Father Frank Brennan. You know, he's a big scholar. He's a Jesuit. He's a theologian. So anyway, it wasn't the time to tell one of Ajahn Brahm's jokes. But I went another way. I had to answer this really properly. So the fellow next to me, Abbot Placid, he was the abbot of the New Norcian Monastery. Made good friends with him. I said, he's been telling me for years and years, every time I meet him, one of his fundamental beliefs is that everybody is searching for God. Don't react. Okay, I'm a Buddhist. Ajahn Brahm, you know, you shouldn't say that or agree with that. You're a Buddhist. But anyway, I said, no, let's wait for a moment. So, I respect my friend. So, if everyone is searching for God, what are Buddhists searching for? What are atheists searching for? What is young people searching for? What do you want in life? And I said, well, I know that being hanging out with all of you for so many years, what do you want when you come here? You want some respect, first of all, no matter what race, religion, sexual preference, age, any infirmity which you have. You want to be respected. So if someone's in a wheelchair, make sure this place is friendly for any disabled. They're respected. They don't have to change before they come in here. They're respected. And they want to be cared for. And it's a wonderful thing to be loved. So don't you miss that, Ajahn Brahm? Ooh, I get heaps of love. And the ability to love and care for somebody else. And they want peace in their life. They want to have peace in their family, peace in their world, so they can enjoy their life as best possible way they can. To find, you know, they're going to have some problems, difficulties in life, but that's part of life. Welcome to that. It's not wrong when someone gets injured or somebody shouts at you. That's part of our life, so we welcome that. We want respect, peace, you know, to look after. We want to have some safety, which is important. Security in the sense of as much safety as we can, respect. Never sort of, we never want to be rejected and demeaned, no matter who we are, how old we are, and what we do in our life. So we want, this is what we search for. And I went on a bit longer, and I said, well, if my friend Abbot Placido, who I respect, if he says everyone is searching for God, and that's what Buddhists search for, that's what the meaning of God is. Respect, care, love, peace, safety. So, that was my answer to him. And that was an answer you may not agree with. I hope you'd see the meaning of that. But what it did, it destroyed walls between people. It managed to bring people together. If you can love yourself, then you can love others, no matter who they are. No matter who. So anyway, I've gone on for too long, as usual, but you've stayed with me, so thank you. So we can now just bow 3 times to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can all just stay here, ask more questions, or go home, whatever you need to do. Oops.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namah.